Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to ID the Future. This is Dr. Michael Eggner, and I am guest hosting today. I am a professor of neurosurgery at Stony Brook Medical School in New York. And in today's episode, I have the privilege and the pleasure of speaking with our guest, Dr. Edward Fazer, who is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Pasadena City College in Pasadena, California. Dr. Fazer is my favorite living philosopher, and I have read many of his books. He is a prolific writer. He's an author of, as I count them, 11 books, as well as many academic and popular articles. And he has a superb blog, appropriately called Edward Fazer. And I read his blog regularly. National Review described him as one of the best contemporary writers on philosophy. I agree with that, although I don't know that I would restrict it to one of the best, and I don't know that I would just restrict it to contemporary. He has a rare gift for offering deep philosophical insight with remarkable clarity. And he introduced me personally to Aristotle and to Thomas Aquinas, which is an enormous gift in itself. His latest book is Aristotle's Revenge, The Metaphysical Foundations of Physical and Biological Science. It is an important and profound book, and it's my privilege to welcome Dr. Fazer.
Thanks for having me, and thank you for that very kind introduction. I appreciate it.
And thank you. I think our listeners would like to know, why is it important for scientists to understand philosophy?
Well, that's a good question. And as I say in my book, where I'm defending, as you can guess from the title, I'm defending the Aristotelian philosophical position, specifically Aristotelian metaphysics and what I call Aristotelian philosophy of nature. I'm not defending it by way of trying to show that scientists themselves have to be deploying Aristotelian philosophical concepts or necessarily even any other philosophical concepts in the practice of doing science, or even to some extent interpreting the results of science. What I am claiming, though, is that contrary to what many people think, including many scientists themselves, the findings of science don't in fact undermine the broad outlines of Aristotelian philosophy of nature, but in fact presuppose them. So it's not so much scientists in their role as scientists who will necessarily find what I say in the book interesting, but rather scientists insofar as they want to reflect philosophically on the nature and implications of scientific findings. So I guess what I want to say in response to your question is that if the question is, are scientists going to benefit qua scientists from studying Aristotelian philosophy of nature and metaphysics? Well, you know, not necessarily. But scientists, like everybody else, are interested in philosophical questions. And many scientists do, in fact, comment on philosophical questions. And insofar as they're doing that, I think that they should and will find what I have to say in the book interesting, and that they should be informed about the Aristotelian approach, since I happen to think it's the correct approach. And I also think it's one that science itself, maybe not the actual practice of science, but at least the implications of science and the presuppositions of science, I think inevitably rest on an Aristotelian foundation.
What would Aristotle say about the opinion that nature is a big machine? Is it a machine?
Well, I would say that it is machine-like in certain respects and not in others. And the respects in which it's not machine-like suffice to show that the model of nature as a vast machine or mechanism is really not the best model. The machine model of nature is one that entered the center stage of Western thought around the 17th century with the rise of early modern philosophy and the scientific revolution, rise of early modern science. And the idea, the way it's often presented is as if it displaced an older organic model of nature, where people think that the Aristotelian model of nature was essentially an organic model. Well, there's some truth to that, but it's potentially misleading. So let me comment on some of these different issues here. First of all, was Aristotle's conception of nature organic? It depends what you mean. If the question is, did Aristotle or the Aristotelians of the Middle Ages think of the natural world as like a vast organism or something? The answer is no, they didn't think it was a vast organism. So in that sense, it could be a bit misleading to say that they had an organic model of nature. On the other hand, they certainly did think that intrinsic to all natural phenomena, all natural substances, whether we're talking about living things, human beings, dogs, cats, trees, grass, or what have you, or for that matter, whether we're talking about inanimate phenomena, stones and water and gold and lead and so forth, that all of those phenomena did possess what Aristotelians call final cause or teleology. They were directed or aimed at certain characteristic outcomes and so forth. And they also all have essences or natures. There's an objective fact of the matter about what it is to be gold or lead or a dog or a cat. And nature is carved, you know, at the joints, these sort of sharp demarcations between different natural phenomena. And it's in the case of living things that the reality of essences and teleology or final cause is the most obvious. These things, you know, essences and teleology are, again, for the Aristotelian, present everywhere in nature, but they're most manifest or most obvious in the case of living things, in Aristotle's view. And so in that sense, insofar as organic phenomena, insofar as living things are kind of the gold standard of natural substances, even though they're not the only kind of natural substance, they are still kind of the paradigm case. In that sense, Aristotle and the Aristotelians who followed him in the Middle Ages had what you could call an organic conception of nature. So the mechanical conception of nature that replaced that is characterized by a number of notes, a number of elements, one of which is the idea that natural phenomena are machine-like in the sense that they're made up of component parts, which are often in turn made up of component parts, just as machines are. So if you think of one of the stock examples like a watch, and you understand how a watch works, the idea is that, well, you can decompose the watch into its component parts, like the gears of the watch and the hour hand and the minute hand and so forth. And if you understand how those parts interact with one another, you can understand how the behavior of the whole system arises from that. Well, okay, yeah, natural phenomena are like that. Living things are certainly like that. So in that sense, they're, you could say, machine-like. But the real core of what was called the mechanical philosophy and this new idea that enters Western thought, or at least becomes central to Western thought in the 17th century, that nature is a kind of machine, was not just that natural phenomena are made up of parts the way a machine does, but more specifically, the idea was that we can describe and understand those parts and the substances made up out of them in a way that makes no reference at all to final causes, to teleology, and makes no reference at all to essences in the sense in which an Aristotelian philosopher would understand the essence of a thing. The idea was that all of nature is really made up of nothing more than colorless, odorless, tasteless, meaningless particles in motion. And that's as true of a human body or a dog or a cat or a tree as it is of a stone or a cup of water or a bar of gold or lead or something. So that if you understand how the parts, the fundamental particles, are arranged and how they push and pull against one another in kind of a machine-like way, then you understand all there is to know about these natural phenomena. You don't need to make any reference to any sort of final causality or purpose or teleology. And you also don't need to make any reference to any sort of essence or nature that entails a sharp difference in kind, and not just degree, between a dog, a cat, a tree, a stone, or what have you. So it was the rejection of essences and teleology that was really the philosophical hardcore of this mechanical world picture and what put it at odds with the Aristotelian picture of nature. And it's that sense of a mechanical conception of nature that the Aristotelian would reject and that I argue against in the book.
Well, it would seem if one looks at modern science and the way scientists understand nature, that there's a mind behind all of this, that nature does act in accordance with what seems to be goals or purposes. Is there evidence for a mind, and would Aristotle have said there was?
Well, there are a couple questions here, and that is what Aristotle himself would have said and what Aristotelians or followers of Aristotle would say or should say, such as an Aristotelian like Thomas Aquinas. Where the question of mind behind nature is concerned, the first thing we need to do is to draw a distinction that Aristotelians and Thomists in particular, followers of Thomas Aquinas, and Aquinas as a kind of Aristotelian, a distinction they would draw between two kinds of teleology. First, we have what I call in the book intrinsic or built-in teleology. And then second, you have what you could call extrinsic or externally imposed teleology. And an example I like to use is the distinction between, say, a vine, like the kind of vine that Tarzan swings around on in the jungle. Turns out it's called a liana vine. It's a particular kind of vine that it is, which would be a natural substance. And a hammock that Tarzan might make out of a bunch of vines tied together, which would not be a natural substance in the Aristotelian view, but rather a kind of artifact, an artificial object. And the difference between the two just is the difference between intrinsic or built-in teleology or final cause on the one hand and extrinsic or externally imposed teleology on the other. Now, I'm building up to your and answer your question about mind lying behind nature. And the idea is this, that for Aristotle and the Aristotelian, something like a liana vine has a built-in tendency to carry out certain activities. It has a built-in tendency to sink roots into the ground and to take in water from the soil, say. And that amounts to a kind of teleology. That is to say, the vine aims or is directed at or points at that sort of outcome of taking in water and sinking roots into the ground, say. And that's just something that follows from its very nature as a liana vine. That's just what liana vines do, given their nature. You don't have to make them do that. If you kind of leave them to themselves, that's what they're going to do. On the other hand, when Tarzan takes a bunch of them and ties them together into a hammock, the end or function or purpose or teleology, whatever you want to call it, of serving as a hammock, of serving as something you could take a nap in, that is not built into the liana vines. That's imposed from outside by Tarzan. That's, you might say, an observer relative feature of the hammock. It's true only insofar as Tarzan or somebody else comes along and wants to make a hammock out of them. Now, that second kind of teleology, the extrinsic or externally imposed kind, in a rather obvious way, presupposes a mind that imposes the teleology on the object, on the hammock in this case. Okay, so if we're talking about that kind of teleology that we see around us in nature, that surely points to the existence of a mind, but that's not a terribly controversial conclusion. We know that just because we know that artifacts are made by human beings. The more interesting question is whether the other kind of teleology that I identified, intrinsic or built-in teleology, the kind that the liana vine just has by virtue of being a liana vine, it just follows from its very nature, does that presuppose some kind of mind, like a divine mind? Well, that's a question that's more complicated. Now, Thomas Aquinas, who's a follower of Aristotle, he certainly does think that that kind of teleology points to the existence of a divine intellect. And he spells that, the reasons for that out in his fifth way, the fifth of his famous five ways of arguing for God's existence. And that's an argument that I happen to think is a sound argument. It's an argument I've defended in a few places. But it's an argument in which the existence of the divine mind behind teleology does not follow directly from just the mere fact of teleology, the way that extrinsic or externally imposed teleology points directly to the existence of a mind. It requires an intermediate level of argumentation. And this is something that Aristotelian philosophers and Thomists often present as an objection to the William Paley style design argument. From an Aristotelian point of view, the Paley sort of design argument is a bit too quick. It jumps directly from teleology in nature to a divine mind, where from the Aristotelian point of view, you can get from teleology in nature to a divine mind, but the inference is not direct the way it is from the teleology of an artifact to the existence of a mind. You need a further layer of reasoning to show that even built-in or intrinsic teleology requires some kind of intelligence behind it. And that's an issue that I don't, in fact, get into in this new book, Aristotle's Revenge, because it's not one that is really necessary for addressing the specific issues that I'm addressing in that book. From the Aristotelian point of view, whether intrinsic or built-in teleology in nature is real, and the question whether there's a divine mind that explains intrinsic or built-in teleology are two separate questions. Someone could affirm the existence that there is teleology or a purpose built into nature without necessarily agreeing that it requires a divine mind. I don't think that position is ultimately stable, but nevertheless, someone could in principle take that view. And you do find contemporary philosophers who do take it, the most famous example being Thomas Nagel, who in his book Mind and Cosmos came out a few years ago. Nagel's an atheist, and he's a pretty devout atheist, you might say. He's quite explicit. He wants to hold on to his atheism. But he also is happy to reconsider the idea that maybe Aristotle was onto something, and maybe there is some kind of teleology or purpose built into nature, and he just wants to try to avoid an Aquinas-style fifth-way argument. And while I think that position is ultimately unstable, that is a separate question from whether there really is teleology built into nature. And it's just that thesis, that there is such a thing as intrinsic or built-in teleology. That's the only one that I discuss in this current book.
It's absolutely fascinating. And I think our listeners would agree that the question of a mind behind nature is one of the most profound questions in philosophy and in science. If our listeners want to understand Aristotle on a much deeper level and Thomas Aquinas, you really need to read Dr. Fezzer's books. Thank you, Dr. Fezzer, for joining us. This is ID the Future. Thank you.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.